I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The age of Obama is over, with 2 years left on his presidency. Something new is underway, even if nobody's got a name for it. Conservative Republicans have a lock on Congress and on key governorships and legislatures around the country for the foreseeable future. More striking is the evidence from Tuesday that big money has a lock on the game of getting elected. It's not just that at $4 billion, this was the biggest flood of money for the narrowest turnout in a non-presidential election since 1942. It was more the concentration of billionaires' money, in both parties actually, especially on Republicans in key races, that tipped the mood and the results and will shape the next 2 years and more. Republicans won all five of the most moneyed races. Gilded Age politics might be the kindest thing to call it. In somebody else's country, we'd probably call it oligarchy or plutocracy. We're surveying the new landscape this hour with the writer and Salon columnist Thomas Frank, who diagnosed something very like it 10 years ago in his home state. The book was What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Randall Kennedy of the Harvard Law School is with us too to chart a way forward, and not least to consider what race has to do with the picture. In our Vox Pop sampling on Boston Common this week, the post-election mood was mostly meh.
Well, I feel it was pretty much as bad as we expected. Maybe you have to hit bottom before you can rise again.
I voted Democrat, so I'm feeling bad.
I think the only way to sort of make everybody happy and actually get a decent change is to sort of restructure both parties.
I'm worried about the United States. I think that we're in real trouble on the planet. I'm looking at kids that I'm teaching from China. They're going to eat our lunch.
Basically, what's in control right now is denial, massive denial about trouble in the economy, about global warming. And it manages to win the day with this election, but in the long run, it won't.
And the voter turnout is so small. We don't know what we've got until we lose it, and we have to exercise our right. It's imperative.
Nothing really, for the most part, changes with an election, even though people think drastic things are going to happen. So,
I mean, I'm sure when we get older, and politicians are from our generation, we'll get a little bit more change.
Thomas Frank, welcome back to Open Source. You went back to your red state, home state of Kansas, to see the finish that reelected Republicans Sam Brownback to the governor's office, Pat Roberts to the U.S. Senate. What, if anything, is new out there, Tom?
Well, let me say first how great it is to be back on your show.
Thank you.
And I did indeed go back to Kansas. It was for the first time in, I think, in my life that it was a battleground state. There was a...
Almost.
Almost. Well, no, it was. There was serious money spent there. And the reason for that, it was entirely local. The rest of the country had this, sweeping Republican wave. And Kansas, which is a traditionally Republican state, the opinion polls were showing that one of our U.S. senators, Pat Roberts, was behind an independent challenger. The challenger was going to beat him, according to the polls. And the governor out there, Sam Brownback, who is nationally known, probably better known even than certainly better known than Pat Roberts, because Brownback was this kind of... He was kind of the leading culture warrior back in the 90s and in the aughts. He was in the U.S. Senate for many years and was a sort of superstar culture warrior. And he went back to Kansas a while ago, became governor, and succeeded in making himself seriously unpopular in a very short amount of time. And it looked like he was way behind in the polls, and so it looked like he was going to lose as well. And I wanted to see this happen. I wanted to see what it looked like. So I went back there and spent the last week before the election absorbing the robocalls.
Why is that style of sort of cultural warfare politics still working in a state that economically is hurting so bad?
Well, the culture wars for the right, at least, have receded quite a bit since the since the recession started, you know, and we say, yes, the recession is technically over. I know it's been over for a long time, but for a lot of people, it's like we're still in this slump that never seems to end. You know, their jobs aren't coming back. Their lives aren't coming back. They're now facing up to the fact that they're never going to be live the kind of lives that their parents did. There's a lot of economic negativity that hasn't gone away. And in that climate, the culture wars have sort of been suspended in favor of other issues.
But you could still, you could argue they're still voting against their economic interests, couldn't you?
They most definitely did.
Why?
No doubt about that. I'll tell you the whole story. So Sam Brownback became governor, enacted tax cuts, very, very steep tax cuts on the state level, essentially did away with the state income tax if you are a certain kind of taxpayer, and generally upper income taxpayer. And so it's the state income tax basically only exists anymore for blue collar workers. And they've you know, in this sort of desperate attempt to try to make up the shortfall in revenue, you know, they've increased sales taxes and property taxes and things like that, which also in that state tend to fall on working class people. So the people who voted for Sam Brownback are paying a lot more, and they were very upset. You know, he was very unpopular, and so it looked like economic issues would triumph for once, but they didn't.
How much was the rescue simply a matter of money and television advertising?
Well, I don't know if we'll ever know the complete answer to that, but man, it was wall to wall when I was out there. You know, so weirdly enough, the Kansas City team, the Royals, were in the World Series, and so everybody was watching it, the baseball game. And there were no political ads during the game proper, but as soon as it would end, as soon as the games would end, the barrage would start up again. And the robocalls were really something else, and it was just driving my family crazy. You know, I thought it was kind of amusing. I would pick up the phone and listen to them, and they were pretty funny. And as you might have guessed, the vast preponderance of these ads and these phone calls were from Republicans. And there was also sort of endless mailings and all the other kinds of things. And I'm afraid I don't know all of the facts about it, because I assume there was some kind of sophisticated get-out-the-vote effort that I didn't see.
Everybody expected it, and it wasn't exactly there.
I don't know if people did expect it, but it whatever, you know, whatever happened, the polls were completely wrong, you know.
Right.
And so something threw everything off.
Tom Frank, I'm just wondering, from Kansas to the country, where is the populist fight? Where is the economic-based politics that did show up in four states that voted to raise the minimum
isn't that
wage?
Yeah, well, question. I mean, that's
where's
that
the Democratic lower D lowercase D? Where's the Democratic pushback?
Well, you know, I hate to tell you this, but it's all on the other side. Okay, there was a lot of class warfare in the Kansas election, but it was from Republicans at their opponents. So the independent candidate who is running for the Senate against Pat Roberts, among other things, is not a hedge fund, a private equity guy. That's what it's called, private equity. And so the Republican Pat Roberts just had a field day, essentially doing all the things to him that the Democrats did to Mitt Romney in 2012. And I guess doing it pretty effectively, because he beat the guy, even though his challenger was ahead in the polls. Roberts beat him pretty soundly on election day. And by the way, Roberts wasn't the only one doing that. If you look at Super PAC ads that were run all over America, that theme was pretty common. I'm writing about this for Salon.com right now.
Describe this. I mean, spell out that theme.
Well, this is going to be a little surprising to you. You know who the Koch brothers are, right? Two sort of oil billionaires in Wichita, Kansas. Okay, and they've funded right wing groups all over America, and you know, various super PACs, and they pour money into conservative politics in this enormous way, this really, you know, earth shattering way. And one of the many groups that they funded has taken as its sort of the cause of its heart. You know, this is the thing that they're really going to wave the flag for and really going to fight on. The issue is cronyism. Okay, and cronyism is their way of describing basically any government intervention in the economy, any of the traditional liberal government interventions in the economy. They describe this is corruption. And the reason they have taken this issue up is because it allows them to rail against business and against campaign donations by business people to politicians. Yes, this is the Koch brothers doing this now. And they ran ads on this all over the country, talking about how awful it was that these various Democratic politicians got campaign donations from the insurance industry and presented Obamacare as a corrupt deal. I mean, and they did it in precisely the terms. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which they basically mimicked the kind of language that I myself often use when I'm describing, you know, politics here in Washington, D.C.
The way they swiped
the populist tone.
You know they have test marketed those very words, corruption.
I know, and it drives me crazy because I'm a liberal. I'm on the left. My party wants nothing to do with this kind of politics. You know, some of its leaders do. You know, Elizabeth Warren will talk this way. A couple of them will, but the ones who really matter won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And this is why they get spanked and spanked and spanked. The financial crisis, economic catastrophe of 2008-2009 was demanded a kind of second New Deal. And the country elected Barack Obama sort of subconsciously believing, and in some cases quite overtly believing, that he was the second FDR who was going to bring it to us. There was that cover of him in a Time magazine where they sort of morphed his face into FDR's.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on What's the Matter with Our Politics, with Thomas Frank and Randall Kennedy coming up. Part of the common talk offstage this election year came from a Princeton study of affluence and influence, the title of a book by Martin Gillens. The very short form of a disturbing idea is that the popular will has virtually nothing to do with what the political elite decides. On the phone this week, I asked Professor Gillens to walk us through his finding on the phone.
We kind of expect in a democracy that the preferences of the voters will have at least some important influence over what their government does. And what I found is that really is not the case, that at least ordinary citizens, middle-class Americans, seem to have absolutely no influence over government policymaking when their preferences diverge from those who have power.
How did you confirm that?
Well, I looked at almost 2,000 different proposed policy changes in U.S. Federal policymaking over a period of about 25 years, and assessed the extent to which middle-income Americans, affluent Americans, and interest groups supported or opposed each of those possible changes, and then looked to see which of them actually occurred. And when you take into account all three of those sets of actors simultaneously, that is to say, people with middle incomes, people with high incomes, and organized interest groups working in Washington, we found that while the affluent matters what they think, and it matters where interest groups come down on these couple of thousand proposed policy changes, but once you take them into account, it matters not a whit what ordinary middle-income Americans prefer. Policies that they strongly opposed were just as likely to be adopted as policies that middle-income Americans strongly supported.
Even at a moment when some people would say the hollowing out of the middle class is the problem, is the issue. Can that be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the reasons why that's the issue and why the middle class in the United States has fared considerably worse than the middle class in many other advanced, industrial nations is precisely this lack of political influence.
Is the American Republic as infirm, maybe sick, as our voting process?
you know, I think it's asking a lot of voters or potential voters to get involved in a system where no matter who wins the election, they are dependent on their campaign donors and responsive to their campaign donors, as my work shows. And so, you know, people that sort of tune out, turn off, maybe don't even vote, you know, there's a reason for that. And it's a vicious cycle, right? Because we have a dysfunctional democracy, which discourages citizens from participating, who reasonably conclude that no matter who they vote for, they're not going to get policies that will solve their problems. And so I think to some degree you can blame the voters, but to a greater degree, I think you have to blame the system.
That was Professor Marty Gillins on the phone from Princeton. There's an extended version of our conversation on our website, radioopensource.org. Randall Kennedy is my guest in the studio. South Carolina born, Princeton educated, for 30 years a law professor at Harvard, a prolific public intellectual with a deep focus on race in the law, in marriage, in politics. Randall Kennedy, Marty Gillins shies away from calling the system we have plutocracy. What do you call it?
I think plutocracy would be just fine. I mean, obviously, the people who have the money call the shots. The thing I'd say in light of the conversation that's gone on thus far, I agree with what Tom Frank has said. I agree with what Professor Gillins says. I suppose that my own view is I was very disturbed by the outcome, very disturbed by the outcome. On the other hand, I think I have a little maybe less sense of indignation because my expectations were frankly pretty low to begin with.
Since when and why, I wonder?
Well, for a long time. I mean, you know, I hear people in the last couple of days, people who share my politics. I consider myself a person on the left, but I hear people who are, you know, sort of wringing their hands, and their story is one of downward spiral. And I guess I want to ask, well, you know, frankly, what's the baseline? When were things so good? In America, you know, at what point did we not have the moneyed elites running things?
You know, that's an interesting question I've been posing about it. But for me, one of the touchstones is 1967, the war in Vietnam has been escalated. It's not working. And Nicholas Katzenbach for the Johnson administration said in the Foreign Relations Committee, tough luck. I mean, this is proceeding. And Gene McCarthy came out of that room, called a few reporters together and said, we're going to take this to the people. And I'm going to go to New Hampshire and I'm going to run for president and we're going to test it out with the folk. And, of course, the war continued, but Lyndon Johnson was driven out of office. And there was an affirmation of a kind of public voice that we don't hear anymore, Randy.
Chris, I'm sorry. I think that you're giving, you know, too much credit. The fact of the matter is the war did continue. With all of the upsetment, the war did continue. Richard Nixon became president of the United States, I'll have you recall. I mean,
yes, well, look, there are always illusions that, that drive even real action and our sense of who we are, what the country is. And the idea that you can take it to the people was alive and well in my growing up, and I'm not sure it is anymore.
Well, it's funny. Again, I don't like the rightward drift of our country, but there are things, it seems to me, that we need to recall. We need to recall that the president of the United States at this moment is a black American. Now, in 1950, that would have been viewed as just lunacy to think that a black American would be president of the United States. In 1960, in 1970, in 1980. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, Barack Obama, president of the United States, he became president of the United States in large part through, you know, tremendous change that has happened in our country.
You could say the same thing even more dramatically on gay rights.
Yes.
In the last 20, 10, 5 years even. And it's remarkable.
It is. And that's one reason why it seems to me that people who are progressives ought not fall victim to a sort of apocalyptic thinking.
You're reminding me, so how many years ago did you say to me, Chris,
sort of optimists and there are pessimists, and I'm an optimist. I think I am too. You still are.
I am.
But
yes.
I'm listening also to those people on the Boston Common. They're worried about our country. And that's, they were not highly selected. The woman said, you know, we're in a state of massive denial.
There's good reason to be worried about our country. I mean, you know, I just clapped America on the back for putting in to the, you know, head office a black American. On the other hand, we are seeing a tremendous reaction against that president, and at least in part because of that president's race. So, you know, there's good reason for us to be deeply worried about the state of the United States. That's not new either.
Matt Stoller joins us by Skype from Washington. He works deep inside Congress, and he writes provocatively online about politics and the money connection. You're my insurgent commentator, Matt Stoller, and a wise one. How concerned should we be? I mean, big time.
Well, I mean, you know, you could go, I mean, I'm concerned, but I never really thought that Obama was the guy that he was pretending to be during the 2008 election. So people used to call me a pessimist, but I've actually become a lot more optimistic in the last year or so, because I think people are coming to understand culturally that we have a significant problem in our economic institutions. And that's new and that's good. And the fodder is there for a significant restructuring of our political economy.
How do we get there? How do we get out of it?
Well, so I like to look at history for analogies, and nothing's ever perfect, but looking at an episode in the early 80s when the Democratic Party was organized to undo the New Deal. There was a small group of congressmen and governors. Among them were Bill Clinton, who was governor of Arkansas. Gary Hart was one of them, Tim Worth, Al Gore. And they organized into a group eventually, which became called the Democratic Leadership Council. And they were organized around promoting corporate power instead of populist ideas, with significant reformist ideas about the role of women, African Americans, gay rights, things like that. And they succeeded largely in imposing their view of how the world should work on the Democratic Party. And the current Democratic Party reflects that view. So
I don't know about, and you know, were they conscious fronts for capitalism? They were surely sort of a anti-populist in spirit and in rhetoric.
Yeah, well, they weren't. The New Deal agenda was not an anti-capitalist agenda. It was a free enterprise model in which they chopped up the money power and they chopped up large corporations so that there would be free enterprise, but without any dominant element. And what these guys did is they said, now that's a problem, because these large institutions that are very concentrated have enormous power. It was kind of like the One Ring in The Lord of the Rings. They said, why don't we use that power for more efficiency in these inflationary times to impose a social agenda, that a civil rights agenda, and so on and so forth. And they did that, and that's what they believed in. And now we're in an era that largely reflects that vision. I mean, we have these large institutions like Walmart and these large banks and Comcast and so on that essentially comprise a government. I mean, that's who's really governing us, is these corporations. And the Democratic Party's political economy, the core leadership, believes in that structure. And so if you want to change it, and I think people do, then you replace that leadership with people who have more of a New Deal Jacksonian idea of how to organize the relationship between government and corporations.
Thomas Frank, would you just referee anywhere you like, but specifically on this question of the severity of the problem, the danger to the Republic?
On the one hand, this is something that, as everyone has said, has been going on for a very long time, and so I am not, you know, really upset about it. On the other hand, you can see with the inequality curve, and look, I've been a professional pessimist for decades, and the stuff that I warned about and yelled about and tore my hair about is all coming to pass. The inequality is it gains speed every year. You know, we've elected a president. One of the things I really like about Barack Obama is that he talks about this problem. He's very open about it. And at one point, he said it was the challenging question of our generation. You know, which was the right thing to say. That was exactly the right description. Even under him, it gets worse every year. And you combine that with Citizens United, you know, the Supreme Court decision that has essentially allowed activities that we used to think of as obviously corrupt and has said that they are, no, they are, that those are the things that define healthy democratic practice. You combine those two things together, and it is a recipe for oligarchy. There's no question about it. That is where we're headed now, and it's very disturbing to me. And what's you know, the worst part of it, though, is not when you interviewed the Princeton professor and he was talking about, you know, that the government only answers to the wealthy, and that's disturbing. But it breaks my heart every day is to see, you know, basically working people in this country can't afford the kind of lifestyle that their parents did. Mm. You know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, people that worked in automobile factories, you know, I tell my kids about this, they don't believe me. People that worked in automobile factories could easily have two cars, you know, a suburban home and go on vacation every year.
On one earner, and, yeah.
And one blue collar earner, a guy who didn't go to high school, didn't go to college. And that's simply impossible today. And it's not impossible because the market said we shouldn't do it or because God intervened or something like that. It is this way because of how we have reorganized our economy, because of bad political decisions that we've made over the years and, you know, decisions that we've convinced ourselves have been just really great.
Tom Frank, I
can't stand that. That's the part of all these developments that drives me crazy, is seeing that happen.
Listen, I'm an optimist, but I'm with you. I'm almost catatonic about Citizens United and the effects. I mean, we grew up on these lines about, you know, money is the mother's milk of politics. Of course, there's always been money, but this is ridiculous. This is multi-billions on Karl Rove's queue to settle all the election contest in doubt. It's a monoculture of money, and it comes incredibly fast after that decision. But it seems to be.
Can I throw one other thought in there?
Please.
Sooner or later, we're going to have to figure out some way of, you know, up until now, the Democrats, the other, you know, the Republicans, the benefits to them from Citizens United is obvious and direct. And the Democrats have decided to compete by playing exactly the same game. And at some point, there has to be someone, I mean, there just has to be someone who can figure out an alternative way of playing the political game. You know, there have been creative minds in politics, especially, you know, in the last century. There were creative people in politics. I mean, it seems hard to believe now, but people did come up with inventive solutions to these problems. And I would sure like to see something, you know, someone figure out another way to win an election other than robocalls and a barrage of TV commercials.
Thank you. And please send money now, today. I'm pleading again and again and again. Kansas farmers did it. Texas farmers did it in 1890 and thereabouts. And patricians like Teddy Roosevelt sort of joined them. Randy Kennedy, what's to be done here? We keep waiting for that populist trigger.
Well, you talked about Citizens United. You know, Citizens United is the interpretation of the Constitution by a small group of people.
Mostly from Harvard Law School.
Some of them. And, you know, if we had a different Supreme Court, that could be changed. Now, some people are trying to get a constitutional amendment. That's you know, that's on order. That's possible. I mean, it's not like Citizens United is immovable. It could be changed by a constitutional amendment. It could be changed by new personnel at the Supreme Court of the United States. Of course, that looks more and more unlikely given what just happened, the Senate going, you know, further to the right than it already is. But Citizens United should not be viewed as something that's completely immovable. It's movable. It'll just take a lot of a lot of organizing, a lot of concerted, intelligent, persistent action.
Let's hope. Tom Frank, I want to just say in response to your heartbreak over middle-class families, one of the least things maybe, but breaks my heart, is the deflation of politics as a subject of kind of reflective interest. It's so many games at once of personality and region and history and tradition and accents. To have it crushed under the one subject of money is a horrific loss.
Yeah, but even then, there's I like to say there's always going to be room for for a clever interpretation and for a funny way of thinking about it.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With Thomas Frank, Randall Kennedy, and Matt Stoller, we're trying to put a finger on a hollow space in the politics of 2014. The philosopher Cornel West got pretty close in conversation the other day. We were talking about his book, Black Prophetic Fire, an impassioned history of an endangered tradition from Frederick Douglass to this moment. Dr. West got himself arrested 3 weeks ago in the street protests in Ferguson, Missouri, memorializing young Michael Brown, who was shot by police for reasons yet to come clear. And then Cornel West turned to some 30-year trends in American life.
Well, I think since the 1980s, we have created a culture of callousness toward poor people and indifference toward working people in the name of a society dominated by big money, big banks, big corporations. So the end and aim of life is to chase dollars, and in chasing those dollars and not be cognizant of the system under which we live, a system that allows for 1% of the population to own 42% of the wealth, or 1% of the population to gain 100% of the income growth in the last 5 years. And this is after major catastrophe, major disaster that primarily resulted in poor and working people bearing the cost. We know Wall Street was bailed out. Homeowners in Main Street had to bear the cost. That was a choice not just of the Bush administration, Obama administration with Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, and others coming in and making sure that the major priority was to restore confidence among the very elites who had engaged in criminal activity with no serious relief or support for working people, homeowners, middle-class folk who had to bear the brunt. Middle-class, black middle-class lost 59% of its wealth. Because most black middle-class folk, their wealth resides in their homes, the homes that they lost. So this is really a story that not only needs to be told, but it needs to be much more widely available to really know the truth about the criminality in high places that got off scot-free. And the same is true with police, the connection between arbitrary corporate power and arbitrary police power. Every 28 hours, a young brother is shot by the police. How many police have actually been accountable for their murders? Hardly any at all. And that's just, you can't have any legitimate criminal justice system with those kind of practices. And more people are seeing the system itself as illegitimate. And that's a certain kind of awakening that has tremendous consequences. It could be positive in terms of serious social change. It could be negative in terms of more chaos.
That was Cornel West from New York in a phone conversation. The longer version of the conversation is on our website, radioopensource.org. I put it to all of you, Tom Frank, Matt Stoller, Randy Kennedy, why don't we hear something more of that simple realism in our commentary? I mean, about race and class and incomes and the old definition of politics, who's getting what? Matt Stoller.
Well, I think people don't. You heard some of it during the bailouts. I mean, when you look at the bailouts, right, which really is the fundamental organizing principle of this era. You know, you saw threats of martial law. That was members of Congress talked about that, and you know that was those were decisions as was pointed out that were made by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And there were a lot of threats going around, and now what you're seeing is protest from people who were left out of the deal in 2008 and 2009. So you're hearing it, and you should, because the system has lost legitimacy, and I think that's kind of what you're going to hear increasingly from the kind of right and the left. And it's dangerous, but that is the sad thing that happens when a system loses legitimacy.
Where does the commentary reach you, Tom Franken? Are you satisfied that we're covering it?
Well, I'm doing my best. I like Cornel West. I'm a big fan of his. I mean, he hits the nail on the head. Can I just add one thing to all of this that you've been saying? Something about the bailouts and the financial crisis. Do you remember? I'm not a big fan of Rahm Emanuel, but he said something. This is when he was coming in as President Obama's, I think, chief of staff, and he said you should never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, damn it, we did. As a nation, we let that crisis go to waste. We
I just want to say something. I reject the characterization of we let this crisis go to waste, because I didn't.
Oh, I see what you say. I mean, we as our country. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's important to be specific.
We're in the White House.
Give him a chance, Matt. Go ahead. Tom Frank.
But of course that's right. I'm using the sort of national we there. But you think about the way the Roosevelt administration responded to the crisis. They did bailouts then too, but while they did them, they also completely restructured the banking industry, and we didn't do anything even close to that. Do you remember what Tim Geithner said? It was all about foaming the runway for the banks. Making it a safe for them to land, so that everything could be propped back up and get running again. And here's what I want to say. This is what it's all been leading up to. When are we going to have another opportunity like that? That was a very, a unique once in a lifetime kind of historical situation where we had the guy who appeared to be the right guy, Barack Obama, coming into office exactly when we needed him, to take charge of this horrible situation, and nothing changed. They got everything back to, the way I like to say is we came to a turning point and we didn't turn. And that's what we missed in our time. And I just wonder, what kind of crisis is it going to take before we actually do something about all this? I mean, how disastrous is that next crisis going to be?
Matt Stoller, why do you say, you speak of the meltdown and the bailouts as the sort of the touchstone of our new politics? Spell that out.
Well, okay. So when I hear these conversations, I mean, one of the things that's important to realize is that a lot of this just was personally Obama's decision-making and what he wanted to do and the vision of the world that he saw. And the liberals went along with it. And they said he's for the middle class in 2012 when he ran for re-election. And they made a big deal about how he was very different from Mitt Romney after watching 4 years of decision-making of record inequality. So when you're saying we, I bristle at that word, because it's important to put your finger on who exactly made these decisions and why these decisions were made. And first and foremost, decisions about how to govern the country, and about when you had a system on its back and it was reorganized to throw the middle class out of the system, which is what happened during the bailouts. That decision was made by Tim Geithner. It was made by Barack Obama. It was made by Larry Summers. And it was acceded to by the Democratic Congress in the House and the Senate, who have subsequently lost several elections. And it was acceded to by the Democratic voters, who did not replace their leadership, unlike the Tea Party, which did replace the bailout Republicans. So you have to actually go down the line and say, okay, wait, these were specific policy decisions. They were made by real people. Those people are still trusted with big decisions. And we have not had a reckoning of who made those decisions and why. And now, instead of actually looking at the bailouts as the fundamental reorganization of our culture, which they were, we go on and we say, oh, Citizens United, all this money in politics, as if there was a completely clean system without money before Citizens United passed, which is completely nonsensical. We know that Citizens United hasn't had a huge impact on our country. We know the problems existed before Citizens United. Let's be honest about the real problem here, which is the group of decision makers in the Democratic Party who had unlimited power and chose to use that power to get rid of the middle class.
Tom Frank, I'm wondering if there's a way...
Can I say something about that?
Randy Kennedy, please.
I agree with much of what was just said, except that it seems, these people that you were just mentioning are, in your view, the big villains. The fact of the matter is, I think that there are a lot of people who agree with what you say, but recognize that as bad as, you know, Geithner, as timorous as Obama was, there were other people, namely the Republicans, and they would have been worse. And so I think there are a lot of people who don't want you to train your rhetorical ammunition on the Democratic Party, lop them off, shoot them down, diminish them, and just make it easier for an even worse political establishment to institute itself.
Matt, one more crack on the point. Go ahead.
Well, okay. That might make sense. If the argument for this administration in 2012 had been, oh, this is really terrible, lesser of two evils, they're really evil, but, you know, at least they're not as bad as the Republicans. But that wasn't the argument. When you actually drill down and you say, is this administration, are these people who make these decisions, are they making these decisions to get rid of the middle class? What you find is the answer is they'll say, oh, lesser of two evils. And they'll say, but, you know, there's not really evil. They're actually kind of, you know, they're doing the best they can. They're really trying. And so people don't actually believe that. They are supportive of the choices that were made, right? I mean, that's just, you want to be honest about this. That's what's really going on. And the Republicans, like, it's not like these guys who had complete unified support from the Democratic base from day one. They have done a terrific job of getting rid of Democrats throughout the country. So it's not like these guys have been on the ball in terms of installing a Democratic supermajority. Like, they came in with everything, and they have left the country with more than two-thirds of state legislators in the Republican hands.
Tom Frank, I want to ask you a question about political coverage. Seems to me most of our media cover politics as endless series of fierce fights between Republicans and Democrats. The guy on the street, and the woman too, see politics more and more as the money party against the people. And that sounds a little maybe paranoid or extreme, but I think it's the reality. How do we...
That sounds very 19th century is what that sounds like to me.
Well, some of the best populist roots started.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in so many ways we're replaying, the sort of history of the 19th century. But the populists used to have a phrase. This actually comes out... We talked about Kansas before. I'm from Kansas, and for whatever reason, I know a great deal about populism in Kansas. It was this left-wing third-party movement, and they had, in the 1890s, and they had an expression for it. They called it the money power, the money power. And this came out of the Civil War when a lot of these same people had been abolitionists because Kansas was that kind of place, and they called the South, they called it the slave power. And so they changed that to the money power in the 1890s, and it was a plutocratic system then, and the really funny thing is they were right about that, about the money power versus the people power.
Well, there is some truth there. There's also some truth in the simple notion that politics, grassroots politics, is easier than people have come to think it is, and also that it works. Can we rediscover that?
That's I've never heard that one before. I understood it. It was very, very. It's very hard. It's a lot of, you know, hard, thankless work. You know, building a movement. I mean, we could talk about this. Look,
easier.
If we want to end, I'm sorry.
I say it's easier because I plunged into a Boston mayor's race myself some years ago. I didn't win, but I didn't lose my house either, or my reputation, or a lot of friends. To me, one of the more intriguing telltale stars didn't get elected, but of 2014 was Zephyr Teachout, who ran for governor of New York on a shoestring against multi-millions of dollars, and she got 35% of the Democratic primary vote. If it had gone on another month, if she'd had $5 million, she would have won. There's tinder out there waiting to be ignited, it seems to me.
Absolutely. And the Republicans have been repeatedly, you know, they're the ones lighting it. And they're the ones, look, this is the, so I wrote, it was interesting what Matt was saying before. This is, he was in some ways like sort of reiterating the thesis of my last book, which is called Pity the Billionaires, about the Tea Party movement. And it was massive, you know, public outrage then in 2008 when the bailouts happened. And it continues down to this day. And by and large, I mean, the Democrats were elected in the first wave of that outrage, or Barack Obama and company were elected in the first wave of that outrage. And when they, you know, completely signed off on the Bush administration's bailout plan, and as I said, you know, Tim Geithner foaming the runway for the banks, and you know, all the other sort of horrible deeds that they did, the Tea Party was basically able to steal that, you know, to take control of that populist outrage that's out there, and they're still running with it, as we saw 2 days ago.
Randy Kennedy wants a word.
If we want to really change things in a big way, I think we're going to have to recognize that what we have now is a two-party dictatorship, and I think we are going to have to become more willing to go outside of it and think about, you know, other sorts of parties. You know, the Tea Party, people are really down on the Tea Party. They, you know, I'm to the left. I don't like the Tea Party ideologically, but I do tip my hat to them.
So do I.
And they were very successful in pulling the Republican Party further to the right. People, you know, criticize the Tea Party for being, quote, radical. Frankly, what's wrong with being radical? It all depends on the content of the radicalism. We need radicalism. We need radicalism, however, from the left. And we are going to have to be willing, it seems to me, to think about some new institutional players, maybe institutional players that are outside of the Democratic Party, maybe to push the Democratic Party, you know, in a way in which it's not being pushed now. It's being pushed in the wrong direction now.
Can Hillary change that direction, really?
No, I don't think so.
Can she navigate in these waters?
Again,
when sane, sensible people, including you, believe we're in a two-party dictatorship.
We are in a
two-party. Money owns it all.
Oh, I agree. Nonetheless, there are differences. I mean, as between Hillary Clinton and any plausible Republican challenger, I'll take Hillary Clinton. But let's recognize the limits of our current, you know, Democratic Party establishment.
Why not some sort of convergence of the Dick Durbins and the Rand Paul anti-corporate, anti-imperial right and left?
I'm not sure, and frankly, I've just contradicted myself because I said on the one hand, I'll go for the lesser of the evil. On the other hand, we have to be willing to chance it. I'll have to rethink that.
Tom Frank, what's the chance you want us to watch?
I don't know. I mean, we need a. You know, I wanted to leave you on a happy note, and that happy note would be to say that there is always a chance out there, and the chance is building a movement. You know, as some people I admire a lot used to say, "Don't mourn, organize." Now, that has its own problems. You know, building something from the ground up, but you know, it's very difficult, for example, to form a labor union nowadays, as everybody knows. But nevertheless, I can't help but think that that is the only, that's one of the only possible ways, build a movement.
In the land of the free and the home of the brave, Thomas Frank, why not? Thank you, Thomas Frank, Randy Kennedy, and Matt Stoller. Thanks also to Cornell West and to Professor Marty Gillins at Princeton. You can find longer conversations with both of them on our website. There's also a long conversation with Jill Lepore about the secret, twisted history of Wonder Woman and what it has to say to women and men these days. Our show is produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from interns Maria Jose Fabre and Rebecca Panuka. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our majority whip. I'm Christopher Lydon.